Name, Jason Horsley. Profession, Limitless. This is The Limitless, the podcast in between. You are now listening. You can walk an island way and you work all the dough and dust. Your eyes were staring at me while playing your guitar.
I came walking a long way just for another chap. Then I saw her in the crowd and I looked her in the eyes.
I don't have a plan. The man without a plan. It seemed like we do have a general ballpark. Did you end up listening to more of Anne Diamond?
I listened to a little more, but I ended up having a friend over last night, so I haven't gone as deep into it as I want to, but I actually really enjoy listening to her, like just her voice. She's got a beautiful voice.
Right. That helps.
It does help, yeah, because she's talking about some pretty gnarly stuff.
I mean, one of the reasons I wanted to talk to you about this is because it's something, as I think you said at the time, that you've actually dedicated quite a lot of time to exploring this possibility, which is the idea of art, and in your case specifically music, in the case of Cohen also as well, specifically music, but art in general as a kind of technology.
Yeah.
So let's just start with that, and any thoughts you have on that, and hopefully it'll inspire something in me.
Sure. So, you know, like I do talks on this stuff, so I literally could go on for hours about it, and I'm working on how to just transmit the essence of what it is I do, so when I'm talking about stuff, people have a frame of reference.
Yeah.
The way that I've learned to talk about it is to explain to people, so I compose music, right? And you're asking about art and technology. So the kind of music that I create sounds like regular music aesthetically. You listen to it and you feel like you're listening to an ordinary piece of music. But what makes my music different from other people's is that I'm actually encrypting words the same way that, you know, you talk about like data encryption for computers and technology. Mm-hmm. The most common application being like security. In a similar way, I'm taking words, for example, the name of individuals or the names of plants, and converting them letter by letter into musical notes.
Right.
So if I took the name Jason, right, J-A-S-O-N, in musical notes, that has a translation. J is F.
It's a U. A, it's with a U now, by the way.
J-A-S-U-N. Uh-huh. Jason. So, you know, I would have a string of five musical notes corresponding to those five letters in your name.
Yeah.
And that has no rhythm. It has no extra chords. It's just a string of information, which is very similar to how technology functions. It's the basis of it is pure information, and then it aggregates in such a way that it takes on cultural and emotional and psychological meaning, right?
Right.
So what I like about this method is that it allows a certain degree of creative freedom, and at the same time, there's constraints that are being imposed because I have to work around this melody. So I can put any rhythm to this melody. I can make each note last several seconds, or I can have them, you know, roll down through a scale in a matter of, you know, a single second. And so there's a degree of choice, but also a degree of constraint. And what comes out of that is a unique composition every time. And I've actually taken it a step further now where I'm translating the names of plants, trees, and mushrooms into music. And what I do is I, for example, like the plant rose, like just an ordinary rose, what I did was I translated both the common and the Latin name, so rose, and then also Rosa rubiginosa, which is the Latin name, into a musical melody. And then I gave it this accompaniment with a piano and a little bit of percussion. And what I do as I'm actually writing that music, I'll be drinking rose tea and spraying like a rose aerosol so that my room smells like rose perfume, and I'm literally drinking like the plant essence as I'm writing it, and that's influencing in a subtle way my composition. And if I get to a place, you know, like with writer's block, I'm sure you've had some form of that experience before, like that happens for any medium, including music. And so when I get stuck, I can actually just take a deep breath, drink a little bit of the tea, tap into that plant spirit, and then that is creating these biochemical effects that then get my system moving again, and all of a sudden I'm writing. So it's this technique for songwriters for breaking through writer's block, and at the same time also creating devotional music, and at the same time also exploring this idea of creating musical cryptograms, which nobody has really done. So that's in a nutshell, that's what I'm doing. That's especially what the third book is about, is like this devotional music. And so you and I were just like talking really briefly the other day about Leonard Cohen and how Cohen was this like major public figure in music. And I read a little bit that Anne Diamond had written about his involvement in some experiments. And I wanted to ask you about that because I feel like you'd be more informed than I was. But it had something to do with like they paid $10 a day or something, and he was involved with a group of different students in some sort of tests that may have been related to MK Ultra.
Yeah, it was at the Auer Memorial. It's not actually on public record, but it's what she's deduced. But that he may have participated, yeah, in I think Donald Hebb experiments, which involved LSD and sensory deprivation.
So, like, I've personally experienced LSD and se sensory deprivation,
Wow.
right? So I have to consider, like, when I,
Together in tandem?
well, no, not those two particular chemicals, but like I have experienced both of them separately, and I've also gone into flotation tanks under the influence of marijuana, which itself is, becomes more and more psychoactive when you're
Sure.
in that space. So how come I bring that up is like, when we're investigating these characters, right? You're talking about the stress of unraveling somebody else's public persona because they're like a mirror of your own psyche, and so as you unravel them, you're unraveling yourself, right?
Yeah.
And so think about, for me as a musician, somebody who's been exposed to a number of different spiritual or esoteric currents, and has tried to like synthesize all of that, and is also, experimenting with psychoactive substances, and is also having a certain level of self-awareness as that's happening, which hopefully is preventing me from becoming, sort of like, I'm not sure, like brainwashed or whatever word you would want to use. Like, I have to consider the possibility that in exploring these areas, I am vulnerable to the influence of the very same figures who Cohen would have encountered 40 or 50 years earlier, right? And of course, like, I'm not Leonard Cohen. I don't have that degree of fame. But when he was in his early days as a folk singer and songwriter, he was probably one of a large group of people who were all experimenting similarly, and he just tapped into, his poetic sensibilities. And so how come I'm bringing this up? I was reading something that Anne Diamond had written that. And maybe it triggered me just because I didn't read the full story and I didn't have the total context, but I was a little bit, I don't know, I don't even want to name the emotion, but just something perturbed, I guess. Like she was describing how one moment he would be in these ecstatic states, and then other moments he would be like, it was like a bipolar situation, and he would almost seem possessed by demons, and he would have to wrestle with that, and that was evidence potentially for some sort of like mental manipulation or mind control. That was the impression I got from the way she was writing about it. And if that's accurate, if I'm actually perceiving that correctly, that she's citing that as proof, that for me gives me pause as far as the credibility of her argument, because from my perspective, like human beings, we are, I mean, especially the more and more you get into the kind of spaces that Cohen was exploring, which are very archetypal, you get into places where, at certain moments you're filled up with enthusiasm and excitement and drive, and then at other points you're exhausted. You've been working really, really hard, and perhaps, there's emotional things that are weighing on you too, and so you would appear to be possessed by demons or whatever it
Well, I
is.
don't suppose that she would have cited that as evidence if it was, if that was all it was. But then, if you juxtapose that with the more prosaic evidence of his involvement with experiments and stuff, and his admissions to it to some extent, then, because if you put the two together, then that does become evidence that the one thing that you're saying is dubious as evidence becomes evidence of the other thing. because that is one of the effects, the desired effects of MK Ultra, is to create multiple personalities. And I mean, absolutely, I think we're all multiple to one degree or another. And what the psyche can be forced to do through engineered trauma, presumably it will do naturally under less extreme circumstances. And, you know, even the shift from one mood to another, is a kind of shift of personality. So it's not either or, it's kind of a spectrum in terms of how fragmented we are and how much we are multiple in terms of having these different identities. In the case of that would be particularly so in the case of artists, I would think. So then I would think that's
that.
Kind of what you're talking about as well, as one of the dangers. It's not so much the danger of being co-opted and handled and infiltrated by these other agencies. I think it's the danger that the technology you're working with, I mean, this isn't the same technology exactly as art, talking about occultism and not even just that. They all overlap, don't they? But you're using this technology to explore your own expression, you know, your own and to develop artistic methods and what have you. That technology itself, just as psychedelics, just as occult ritual, any kind of information, but obviously some more than others, a lot more than others, itself, I think, is dangerous, not the right word, because everything is dangerous, but it the danger that you're talking about, that it can induce trances in us and that it can cause fragmentation and dissociation, maybe triggers, we don't even know what was in our past. That is a sense I get, that you're kind of playing with fire, which of course every artist does that. Right?
Every artist does. You have to. And also there's a question like, you know, I'm going to keep this on myself instead of like posing some hypothetical person. Like for myself, I know that I come from a background of, you know, mental health disorders within both of my, you know, both sides of my family. And I personally experienced, you know, my entire childhood, adolescence, adult life, a wide range of emotions. And I would say multiple personalities included, you know, I totally have multiple personalities dwelling within me. And I have an awareness of each one of them as they arise. And I have a hard time believing that Cohen didn't have a similar capacity to recognize, oh, this part of my personality is showing up right now and I'm giving expression to it. And okay, now that's passed. And now this other aspect of my personality is showing up. And
well, that would be assuming, I mean, it's assuming, first of all, you're assuming a similar level of coherence or awareness in Cohen as yourself, which I could see is fairly reasonable, maybe. But then before even that, you're assuming a level of coherence or awareness in yourself that you can't be sure of, because how would you know if a multiple took over and you weren't able to recognize it?
Well, I think that's valid. I think that the very act of perceiving that whole narrative I have of, yeah, there's all these different personalities or different characters and emotions and feeling states in my body that show up at different moments in time, but there's a continuous thread throughout that, and that's myself. Like, it's a very Jungian perspective, but like there's, you know, there's totally, you know, research to say that actually there is no central self and that's an illusion. And actually the narrative that there is a central self itself is a kind of alter or implant. Mm-hmm. And if that's the case, which I'm open to that, that doesn't bother me. Like, I don't see that as a problem because it's a really useful implant, and it, by nature, anytime it begins to acquire a quality unto itself, like it recognizes itself as distinct from that. It's this strange software operating program. So the danger that I see in having that like perceptual, you know, implant is that, like you say, if that perception does not detect something that's operating through my body, like let's say there's, you could call it an entity, or you could just call it like a, you know, an alternate personality or something, mm-hmm. that's coming through me that I'm not aware of, and especially if it's doing harm, whether it's to myself or to others, to my environment, that's a problem. But the real problem isn't the fact that I have like this perceptual implant, you know, self-awareness or whatever. The problem is that self-awareness is not has not delineated this particular fragment. It hasn't recognized it. And so really the task, as far as I can tell, is to integrate as many different fragments of my personality as possible through self-inquiry and through just work and through living and meeting new people and having new experiences and all that. So I guess the reason I'm bringing this stuff up is that when I think about that process for myself of self-exploration and poetry and artistic creation and music, and I compare myself to Leonard Cohen, and I think, well, I see him as being on a higher creative plane than myself, if we want to talk about higher and lower at all. Like, if there were any hierarchy, certainly, like, the quality of what he produces surpasses my, especially lyrically, So, because
right, so
I have,
he's mastered the technology. Then.
He's mastered the technology and the technique. And so, with that, he has earned my respect in the same way that any great artist from any genre would. And so
why,
the
though?
Question,
I mean, why? Yeah, why? Why? I mean, because this is, if it's a technology, then. I mean, this is the crux of what interests me about this and your opinion about this. Like, if it's a technology, then although this might not mean that anyone can master it, and there may indeed be respect that one would want to extend to somebody who masters the technology, it might be a similar kind of respect that one would master to, I could use an extreme case like Dr. Mengele or somebody. I mean, if you have to respect to some extent, just intelligence where it works and where it achieves things that most minds could not achieve, there's got to be some kind of respect in there, I suppose, in that it's acknowledging that there's an accomplishment that is unusual. So if technology is, I mean, if art is a technology, isn't it possible that the way that technology works is to invoke feelings in the listener that aren't earned, so including respect? Because if you can use art as a technology to trigger responses in the listener, those responses could include love, respect, mm-hmm. sorrow, a feeling of wisdom, a feeling of depth, even spiritual epiphanies, but they're not. They're simply mechanisms. I mean, you would have the terminology better than me, but like encoded information that is designed to infiltrate the psyche in such a way that it triggers aspects of the psyche, maybe different alters that then come into being that have this experience, then that gets interpreted by the presiding self as a real experience that's being integrated. But actually what's occurring is more an intensification of the fragmentation and then dissociation. I'm really just riffing now. I'm not sure
okay,
makes sense. But
four things to respond to.
Yeah.
Because I think there's a lot of assumptions in what you're saying. Like, one of them, first of all, it's very mechanistic view of the human psyche, mm-hmm. in my opinion.
Well, that's what MKUltra is, though.
Right, exactly. I mean, if you look at that particular approach, and if we actually consider that perhaps, if not MKUltra specifically, that Cohen was involved in one or multiple programs that were designed to sort of invoke this particular archetype of the sublime poet, let's say. If you have a group of doctors or scientists who have discovered this sort of hack into the human mind through the use of, I didn't know, like Donald Ewan Cameron and MKUltra, his whole method was like he would have people in a contained environment, and he would feed them some sort of psychoactive substance. I forget if it was LSD or what it was, mm-hmm. but and then he would have them speaking about their life experiences, and he would record them, and then at the most traumatic moments, he would then create little tape loops of that particular thing and then play it back for them while they were under the influence of these drugs in such a way that it would literally wash away any sort of associated feelings or thoughts they had, and at that point that would create a blank space where then a new personality could be inserted, right?
Roughly,
wasn't that kind of
some that was part of it, the psychic driving, yeah.
The psychic driving. So, yeah. So whatever the method is, right? Let's just say hypothetically that there was one or multiple agencies who were involved in something like that with Leonard Cohen, right? That, first of all, we're talking about a technology. You used a language like the infiltration of the psyche, right? Like the infiltration is happening by, these hypothetical groups or agencies that are handling Leonard Cohen. That's the infiltration. But the idea that because his psyche was infiltrated by these nefarious organizations and they implanted something which caused him to have access to a particular plane of poetic expression.
Like Whitley and his visitors, yeah, carry on.
Sure. Or any artist, really. I mean, you look at any great artist who suffers from mental illness, you could, you know, kind of posit this kind of thing, especially if you spend years trying to amass the evidence to prove it. But point being, even if that's the case, the fact that he's been infiltrated doesn't necessarily mean to me that the listener, by having emotional experiences, which you say, your words were that they haven't earned them, that's somehow inherently negative. Like, I think that in that picture, what you're saying is that the fact that there was a nefarious agency who infiltrated the psyche of one man, and that that man then had the ability to tap into something, this archetypal, you know, role, and then transmit that to people, that the abuse implicit in the original implant is now inseparable from the poetic transmission.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right? Is that what you're saying? And I'm not sure I agree with that. Yeah. Like, I think I disagree with that.
I'll tell you why I think that, if you want, or I'll try to.
Please.
So according to Anne Diamond and her memories, one of the phrases that Cameron put into people's minds during that psychic driving programming was. I'm a failure, you know, nothing I do is worth anything. So, and just using this as an example, but if somebody like Cohen was programmed with that at a very deep level, that they were a failure and that it would never amount to anything, you could see how that would cause the drive to kind of try and overcome that programming. Mm-hmm. Because this very deep drive to actually succeed and to prove that wrong, you know, to get free of that very deep program. And okay, so that's a sort of exaggerated version of what happens to all of us to some degree or another. We get programmed early in life by negligence or abuse, or, you know, the critical gaze into feeling that we are worthless and that we have been invalidated. We haven't received the validation that we need, and so then we spend the rest of our life seeking that validation. And I think that that's largely behind the artistic impulse, not to mention every other impulse in the world, is to get validation, to do something that will prove ourselves worthy in somebody else's eyes and in our own. So, and the extent to which that, I mean, what I would say then is what motivates the creativity is inseparable from the nature of the creativity itself. What's actually underneath the drive to create and express? If it's a drive to actually achieve validation, status, power, control, which is basically what we're talking about. You know, if one is neurotically driven to create, then that's what's underneath it. So we're talking about something that is quite archetypal, that is in all of us, and Leonard Cohen may be just, you know, a very magnified example of that. And in a certain sense, you don't need the agencies, which are not hypothetical, by the way, they're very well documented, but the agencies of CIA and so forth, you don't necessarily need them because to understand how this works or to see it at work, because we've all been mind control to one degree or another, right?
Okay, right.
So then we're talking about the archetypal question of, am I creating simply to, because there's a need to express my soul and to discover what is within my soul and to discover who I am, or am I creating because I want to influence others and I want to have power and control over others?
But isn't it going to be a little bit of both for everybody?
Well, to some extent and up to a certain point, yes. But if it were true about Cohen, then it would be really heavy on the side of the negative, as you put it.
Thank you.
Right. Okay. So I see what you're saying. Like the idea, first of all, I'm not questioning the existence of agencies who participate in mind control experiments. Like I know that that's real. I think what I'm questioning is whether or not Cohen was actually, involved in those projects or not. But I totally get what you're saying about being driven to create, especially if there's a heavy influence on creating for the pursuit of status and power and all of that. But if that's, let's say that's a motive force, right? So you're Leonard Cohen. You've been, through hypnotic suggestion, you've internalized this voice that says you're not good enough. You need to do more. You need to do more, right? That critical voice, that's like the cracking of the whip. That's to me, it's kind of irrelevant whether or not that voice by itself came through an agency or whether it was just the influence of his culture. Like you said, like that's something that we all experience to some degree. And I guess it becomes relevant only at the political level. Like if in fact Leonard Cohen was I don't want to call him an agent because he was unwitting. So if he was a mind control victim, let's say, then the question is to what ends? Like why would they create that character? And I think that opens up a whole other avenue of inquiry as far as like social control and social manipulation and controlled opposition of the counterculture. Like, and so that itself, I think, is probably like where there would be some incentive to paint this picture, because then you can start looking at figures like Dylan or Cohen or Paul Simon or whoever it is, like these major influential figures as valuable pawns essentially in the hands of the controllers, whoever they are. Right? But I want to come back to what you had said originally, which is that the people have not earned those emotional experiences that are being transmitted.
The artist who's invoking them hasn't earned them.
See, I don't agree with that. Like, I think if the only alter that we're talking about is that there's this implant that says you're not good enough, that the emotional pain and suffering that comes with feeling like you're not good enough, is catapulting you as a creative person to get in touch with whatever will help you to feel good enough, right? And so then you begin grasping,
Exactly. So you
right?
become an addict of
You
good
become,
feelings.
well, you become an addict if you're dysfunctional, but if you're functional, you become a superhero. You
It's
become
the
a
same
star.
thing. I mean, you become Whitley Strieber. You become Leonard
Oh.
Cohen. The superhero is the dysfunctional. That's the
Right.
point. So this is a these are disembodied voices that we're admiring. That's the power of it. Never mind the actual specific weaponized memes that are conveyed through the music, which in my interpretation of Cohen has to do with worship of the female, for example. I think this is a very key thing. So there is actually information coming through the songs, which is, let's not say destructive, but dissociative, that takes us away from reality. But beyond that, just the fact of having disembodied voices in the culture that we look to and listen to and emulate means that we are actually emulating and imitating and developing in ourselves a similarly disembodied voice. We are giving power to the fragment. Like
When
how
you
I
say
see,
disembodied, can you just clarify what you mean by a disembodied voice?
I think I probably was going to there because it was about the power of the fragment. So this, and this is all quite new to me, so I don't know how coherent it will be. But that I think one of the things that MKUltra was doing had to do with creation of charisma of these cultural voices, and that the way part of how they created charismatic figures, false ceremony masters indeed, was that if you fragment the psyche, somehow that allows for a fragment to take possession of the life force. And so you can create a very charismatic persona that is essentially disembodied because it's just a fragment of the psyche, and so it can't actually land in the body. It's just floating out there somewhere outside of the body. But because of the psyche's been fragmented, the life force is not able to land in the body. That life force can get siphoned off by the fragment. And so that fragment is the superhero that you're talking about. It seems superhuman. It seems to, and in a way it has powers that we don't have because it's disembodied. It can dematerialize, it can levitate, it can jump tall buildings because it doesn't have any roots. So,
Okay.
yeah.
Like when you're talking about a person is disembodied, there's a psychic fragment which is sort of split off from his consciousness, which is usurping a certain amount of life force energy, and there's no way for it to land in his body. And yet, the only way that we can prove that that exists is by looking at artifacts of his life, things.
Well, no, we can look at our own lives. You know what disembodiment is about. You've suffered from it your whole life. Not being able to be comfortable in your body. There isn't integrity between the soul and the body. So it's more like the fragment is using the body as a means of expression that will keep it in the illusion of being a whole self. It becomes an operative.
Talk about this in terms of our own work, then, because Leonard Cohen, neither of us know him. So, and this is the problem for me with like conspiracy or researching a third party, is that I have enough self awareness to be able to speak to my own experience about myself and you for yourself. So, like if we can bring it to the personal level, I think that'll help. So for myself, like I have no memory of being involved in mind control programs, right? And yet it's still possible that I have been exposed to something of that kind. So I feel like, but I can talk about this just from the perspective of being a musician who works with, I definitely have disembodied voices in my psyche. Like if I'm just quiet and sitting in meditation, I will hear voices from random people, like saying completely useless things like, oh, I thought you were going to go to the store today, you know? And it's like, wow. And it's coming through the voice of like a white woman in her mid-30s. And I'm like, who is that? Or, you know, so there's random figures existing, and I don't have an established belief system to say, oh, I'm picking up on somebody in my building, or I'm picking up on something in the field. Like, I don't have a framework for those disembodied voices. I don't believe it's schizophrenia. Like, I haven't pathologized it, but I don't have a working spiritual or esoteric model that I use to explain away the experiences or explain them at all, right? So when you're talking about the disembodied voices, like I'm drawing a parallel between that terminology and that experience that I've had within myself, within my experience. So, so if that's an accurate comparison, like this sort of disembodied voice that doesn't belong to me, but it's still existing in my own psyche, if that connection works, then what I would say is music operates in a similar way. Like I am pulling through little melodic fragments and different chord progressions, and part of that is experimentation. So it's kind of like it's like doing massage therapy, right? Where you're flowing with whatever the body naturally wants, but you also have techniques that you can apply, right? So you're massaging a melody into a full song, and that takes work. And that work is embodied in the sense that like it takes physical energy. You have to have stamina, right? So that's for me the embodiment piece, even though the music itself is disembodied. And so the notion that because it begins as a disembodied spirit that I then channel through my physical body, that it's still disembodied, like I just disagree with that, and I'm not trying to be combative or confrontational or anything. I just don't agree with it. So it makes it difficult to use the same terminology that you are.
Well, I think there's a couple of things. I mean, I think one thing, you're a lot more invested in being an artist than I am, and particularly in being a musician. So I think that could be quite fraught between us. The other thing that's definitely less fraught, kind of neutral, is that you're using disembodiment in a much more literal way. So when I talk about disembodied voices, I just mean voices of individuals who are not embodied. That was all I meant by disembodied voices. So then,
for example, like a character in a Leonard Cohen song who's not Leonard Cohen's personality would be an example of that?
No, it would be Leonard Cohen. Leonard Cohen, in my view, is not embodied.
Okay. So if he's singing one of his songs, he's got his guitar in hand, he's playing the guitar and singing, and you would say he's not embodied.
Yes, in the way that I use the term, like embodiment being the goal of, you know, like a whole person, somebody who's whole, is embodied.
Okay.
So there's very, very few people that are embodied. That's why I could say with confidence that I don't think Leonard Cohen is, because I've only met like one person that I consider embodied and not even sure about him. So I'm using it in a very specific sense, which is that, and it is something that could be measured if we had the tools to measure it, God forbid, but one can measure it in one's own life, I say, I presume, because I can incrementally observe how I am incrementally more embodied over the years. Forgot where I was going with that. Technically speaking, that the psyche is a reality. It's not just a word for something. The soul is a reality, which, let's say, just as much as the body is. But the body, we can see it, we can touch it, we can map it, we can describe it, we can figure, we understand it. The soul is off limits, right, to our instruments. But anyway, let's allow that the soul is just as much as real and even physical, but in a different sense to the body. So the psyche, embodiment to me means the psyche that is fully landed in the body. That's all.
I think of Christ or Buddha or like a fully enlightened being.
Yeah, well, I wasn't going to go there, but that's, yeah. That, if they wear anything, then that's what I'm talking about. Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. Well, that makes sense. I mean, if you're saying, is Leonard Cohen enlightened to the degree that the character of Christ or Buddha are, like, I would agree with you. Like, if that's how we're talking embodiment, that like full embodiment essentially means total liberation in the Buddhist sense. Like, yeah, I could sign on that Leonard Cohen was still grappling with demons and was still in the process of whether you call it individuation or whatever.
Sure, which of course would not invalidate him as an artist. What would invalidate him as an artist or a real ceremony master is what is his motivation and what is his methodology. And so if he was programmed, or if anyone, any of us, as you rightly pointed out, and as I pointed out and you agreed, we've all been programmed to different degrees. We don't even know if we were inducted into mind control programs, because part of the method is amnesia. So we really don't know this, and it'd be stupid to assume anything. But we can know that our minds are kind of unknown to us and unruly, and we have all kinds of different forces, warring in our psyche. So to some extent we know where we're conflicted. Where was I going with this? Okay, so it was about Cohen and to some extent all of us. What's the motivation, what's the methodology? So for me, I mean, the part, this is a big part of the struggle, is like, how much of my artistic expression, my creative expression, my self-expression, which is creative in some sense, is helping me to become embodied? Is how much is it the result of, more than the means to, but a bit of both, of me going deeper into the wound, as we used to say in Sweta, deeper into the dysfunction? And how much is it a way to escape from that pull, that necessary journey? And it really is either or. You can't go in both directions at the same time. You can vacillate. You can sometimes be creative and expressive, think you're being expressive when in fact you're just fabricating, pretty images of yourself to make yourself feel better. And then you can, pull yourself together and say, no, that's not the way to the truth, and then go into the shit. And even if what you create is something you wouldn't want anyone to ever see, you keep going because that's the way to reality. You can fluctuate between the two, but eventually at any given time you have to decide, I think, I do, which counts for more, which is real. And for me the answer is not. Even there's no discussion. I know which is, I don't know how to discern which is real and which is not at all times, but I know which has true value, and that is getting to the truth of me. So if somebody like Cohen, and I think this is true of all these cultural figures, and this is how this whole thing works to some extent, if they have made the deal with the devil and said, no, I don't care about going into the wound and getting to the truth of me, that is far too painful. What I want to do is create a perfect simulation of my embodied self and give all the power to one fragment and give ascendancy to that fragment, so it will rule over my psyche and have power over the masses. It's like Jesus in the desert, right, bowing down to Lucifer. He never did, but he had the option. If that's what happens, then yeah, power is bestowed upon you and you become this cultural influence. But it's not. There's something in the product then that it's the brain waves, right? The medium is the message. The medium is the message, right? So however beautiful those songs, they are, and you're talking about this in the music, how you create music, that they have encoded in them specific information, not in the, you know, small sense, but in the wider sense of like psychic information, like the state of this soul and the alignment of this soul communicates in the song.
Mm-hmm.
And then it recruits people to it. Yes, I want that. I want to be that somebody. I want to be powerful. I want to be the poet. I want to be the artist.
Mm.
That, you know, that's the subtle influence. And yeah, have to bring it to ourselves. I love learning Cohen music. I did. I can't change that because aesthetically they please me. So how did that harm me? Well, I haven't done much looking intellectually, but it did occur to me, as I said a moment ago, that the period I was listening to Leonard Cohen was very key in my life because it was the period in which I put my total commitment to one woman in the sense of this is the meaning of my existence, is binding with this woman, and nothing else means anything compared to that. And that is why I threw away my fortune. That is why I almost died, or at least I put myself in circumstances where I very could have easily died. So I was suicidally driven because of that value set that said that this woman is more important to me than anything in the universe. And that is very much embedded in Leonard Cohen's music. That's part of the poetry. He worships women.
Sure.
And that is, I think that's a very fundamental deception, actually, in our culture and archetypally speaking. If you choose the woman over the soul, you will go down. You know, you will miss the boat that you want to catch, right? Because it's not a woman.
Yeah, that's a profound thing, because you had mentioned that earlier in this talk too, that just briefly, the thing about that you know, he worships women, and I was thinking at that moment, I bookmarked, like, why is that a problem, or why is it? But I can see how that ties into your narrative, because if you idolize somebody like that, who, rather than singing about I'm not sure exactly what lyrics would look like that weren't like oriented to a romantic love life, whatever that would be, but just a song about your own experience and about the development of your own soul, that potential, like the audience, the listeners who are internalizing you as a role model will sort of orient their lives accordingly, right? So I've been thinking about this a lot, actually. There's a parallel, like, that in Los Angeles, New York City, like in a lot of big cities, there's this emerging rap culture, a battle rap culture. And the entire goal of this community is essentially to create a container where two people can actively disrespect each other through rhyme, right? So it's such an interesting art form. It's poetry, but it's also insults, and it's contained in such a way, you know, people hug it out before and after. There's a sense of community around it, and yet the basic premise of that whole culture, much like wrestling or boxing or anything, is you get in the ring with another guy and you just try to beat the shit out of him. And on the one hand, it can be cathartic, right? Just like a song about your broken heart because the woman that you love doesn't want to be with you, or or whatever. Like, these things that can be potentially poisonous can also function as a source of catharsis.
Yeah.
And I think that a lot of people can relate to the lyrics that Leonard Cohen was singing about, you know, the Sisters of Mercy, or just these women who, for whatever reason, as a man, like, he was struggling to get in touch with certain parts of himself, but through woman, he was able to encounter more of himself, and he had all these experiences, and he's going to communicate that through poetry. Like, the fact that you as a listener were informed by that. And let's say if he was an MK Ultra, you know, victim, then his whole drive for wanting to connect with these women was driven by his sense of not being enough, right? So a desire for completion, the desire for the anima, for the other, to become whole again, right? So taking that individuation process too literally, and instead of realizing that the woman is really a symbol for something within our own self, you took that, and so there's a very personal element to this for you, which I think is interesting, and I can really relate to that, because Leonard Cohen, similarly for me, I listened to him during a, you know, a period of time when I was doing a lot of really intense self-work, and the melancholy of his music, like the sweet melancholy, you know, the tenderness of his sadness, was a source of comfort for me. But it also reinforced that state, right? So you're taking refuge, to take refuge in something like Christ or the Buddha, who represents, you know, the enlightened state, versus taking refuge in a character like Bob Dylan or Leonard Cohen, these characters who are who have not achieved total liberation, means that we are going to be internalizing their neuroses,
I think so.
almost,
Yeah, I mean, we're
yeah,
reinforcing our own.
reinforcing our own. Let me ask you this about the embodiment thing. Like, let's say for Leonard Cohen that he had decided not to create that music, right? So he's got this implant now that's saying you're not good enough, you're not good enough, and he doesn't act upon that by defying it and proving his value. He just sort of surrenders to that he's not good enough. Like, that is a very damaging belief to hold, and regardless of whether or not we've internalized that sense of not being good enough from our culture or from like a particular agency that's, you know, targeting us, is kind of irrelevant, because either way, I think most people have that sense of like, life is a struggle. Like, to get through life, if you really want to, you know, have access to resources, you've got to hustle. Like, there's all these sort of built-in assumptions about what it takes to do, to enjoy some degree of freedom and autonomy as an individual in this world. So, like, you know, we look to the people who have succeeded in order to gauge what our actions and behaviors and attitudes should be. So, I'm just sort of flying by the seat of my pants now, but like, I really feel that with Leonard Cohen, he to me represents somebody who was emotionally sensitive, poetically expressive, and still made a fortune. Now, what I'm discovering through reading the work of Anne Diamond and your reflections on her work is that he also was hanging out with these millionaire Republicans, and his political views were actually very conservative, and he supported war, and he's, you know, in some moments he almost appears to be supporting tyranny in his attitudes about police and so forth. So, like, there, it's interesting, the persona that gets put off, like the sensitive poet warrior, right, is not necessarily the whole person. And maybe that's where you get into this fragmentation. You can have somebody who holds political views that are totally incompatible with the persona that they're projecting into the world. And at that point, you get into, oh, well, that's disingenuous, that's deceptive. And at that point, that's where I can see people really taking issue, because on the one hand, you're like, I am, as the audience member, I'm internalizing the sensitive warrior poet, you know, Leonard Cohen, and but I'm only getting a percentage of his whole being, and so I may think, oh, I want to be like Leonard Cohen and write songs like this, and but I'm missing out on all these other things which were part of the chemistry that brought him to who he is. And
Yeah, you're taking the whole package. I think when you just take a piece that you like, and that's the piece that's put forward and marketed as the whole, you take that piece and you're actually taking the whole package, the hidden parts also.
yeah. And that's the danger, right?
Yeah, and I think it's weird, to see and try and, and the value in looking at Leonard Cohen isn't, and finding these discrepancies isn't to say, oh, he's not what he seems, and to judge again. It's because they're clues and they indicate the whole package, and one can start to uncover the whole man and realize, what's there, and that's that. There's a value in that, in seeing the whole thing in itself. I forgot I was going to go there. Actually, I was going to go somewhere. There's quite a few things because we're talking quite quickly. I wanted to go back to the woman thing quickly because I think we didn't finish it. Because Cohen's, the way that he presented man, woman, love, it wasn't like the Beatles, or even Bob Dylan. It was, he had a cosmology of sexuality. So, I wasn't susceptible to, particularly to, Beatles kind of romanticization of sex as a young man. But I was totally susceptible to Cohen's version because it was, it was kind of alchemical and it was tantric and it had all this occult, arcanic, symbolism in it and all the rest of it. But still, at the heart of it was this essential thing of the idealization of the female and the deification of the woman, the woman's body. And okay, so there's that. And then the other thing that about Cohen that you didn't mention is that his treatment of women is pro was seems to be pretty shitty, and that the I mean, particularly if we take Kelly Lynch's version of what happened over Cohen's, and I am inclined to at the moment so far, he pretty much destroyed her life and or had his his helpers do that. And that was Andiamond's observation about Cohen, was that he either worshipped women or he destroyed them. And the two go together. The worship is actually a kind of subterfuge by which to destroy women. I mean, it's a sublimated hatred of rejection, fear of women. And this is in my own case too. Like, while I was on this romantic quest for oneness with a female, that led to my own downfall, as you know, I was also wrestling with very violent ideation against women, which I can't blame on Leonard Cohen. It was in me long before I'd heard of him, but I would say that it's a matching pattern, a matching trauma that is part of the whole complex there that's being uncovered. And this isn't about, oh, this music is bad and Leonard Cohen was bad and now we have to reject it at all. It's about putting it in the right context, because you know me, I mean, I wouldn't say out now that MK Ultra is bad. It happened, right? It had results, it had fruit. Most of them probably are what we'd call bad. But nothing is, I mean, we're not in a position to judge something at that level in terms of whether it's good or bad. At least let's get all the information that we can on the table and actually begin to look more deeply at the causes and the effects and all the rest of it. So that's what it is for me with Cohen and with music, and it's just not what it seems. And it's so far from what I thought it was that the tendency is to say, oh my God, it's demonic or something like that. Of course, I never resort to that language, but emotionally, I might, there'd be something in me that is feeling, oh, I've got to get free of this.
Well, that's the part that I relate to the most of everything that you've shared, which is this idea that through listening to music that was created in a certain frame of mind, let's say, where if Cohen is driven to sublimate the feminine as a way of masking his hatred for women, let's say, whether it's that whether the hatred is conscious or unconscious, right? If the music is being used to mask that, then you can't actually separate the fruit from the tree. And so by taking in that music, you're reinforcing the patterns as a listener for you personally, like that would have been created when you're watching violent films earlier in your life,
Right.
right? So I really get that piece. I think that that's applicable to every artistic medium, and that's like the weaponization, not just of music, but of information transference between human beings, from basic communication all the way up to, you know, Hollywood and mainstream media and you know, politics and all the rest of it. Like at every level, you're going to have individuals who are covering up their true intentions or covering up the true sources of inspiration in order to achieve whatever they think their most important goals are. So I don't see Cohen as an isolated incident. I see him as the rule rather than the exception to the rule. I think we're all creating whatever it is that we do in our life, like as artistic creative people, we're all drawing inspiration from deeply personal experiences, many of which were traumatic or challenging, or if nothing else, like shocking. Perhaps they weren't traumatic or negative, but they were shocking. And those shocks become informative. So if you can administer the shock to a select targeted number of people, and you can actually, you have some way of keeping a hand on, you know, gently guiding them towards different stages of their life, then conceivably, especially with a mainstream musical figure, you know, you're booking their shows, you're determining which events they go out and have to make appearances at. Like, you really are handling their life in such a way that conceivably something like this could happen. I think when you get onto the smaller scale of people like yourself and me, probably what you and I are encountering in our psyche, you know, is more the run-of-the-mill human experience of just there's all these different forces operating in our psyche, one of which is this sort of like conscious perceptual mechanism, and the rest of it, which is just everything else. And we're just navigating that to the best of our abilities. And that's all I'm trying to say is that you can't separate my psyche from the music that I create using this method. But I think you're right that in terms of, you know, whether you're if you're creating devotional music for women as a whole, and that's the ongoing theme, versus if the you know, for me, I'm not only focusing on plants and trees and mushrooms, I'm also doing this for people. So I'm translating people's names. I work at a bakery. I took the first name of everybody at the bakery and turned it into a musical theme. So
Okay,
it's
let me
really.
just interject a question then. Is
Sure.
how arbitrary is the system by which you're translating names and letters into musical notes or whatever? Is it one you've invented or?
No. So it's both arbitrary and not, depending on how you use the word. So it's arbitrary at the sort of bioacoustic physics level, right? There's no correspondence between the letter A and the musical note E. Like, it is an arbitrary correspondence. But the root of these correspondences has history. Like, it goes back over 100 years. And this, I mean, we're reaching 2 hours, so I don't know if there's time to open up this whole thing, but you know, but basically that the root of the system comes from a guy, Paul Foster Case, who was the head of a group called the Builders of the Addendum, which was a sort of pseudo-Masonic, like what they would call a Blue Lodge. So the first three initiatory degrees, and then they have various other degrees that come on top of that. And what you know, he was trained by the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn, which was the magical society in the late 19th century in London. I know you know about them. And so basically there's a lineage of Western ceremonial magic, which itself is like ties into all of this. The whole idea of ceremony and ritual as it relates to mind control is huge. And especially, I mean, I'd say when people think about mind control and music, usually they think about the Illuminati, right? That's like the classic, like if you go on YouTube and type in music Illuminati, you'll see all these rappers and pop musicians, because the idea is that these people who come into positions of power and influence in the media are actually just puppets, and how they're puppets is that there's people who have way more money, way more power, way more political influence than they do, who are dictating everything that they do as performers. And so, you know, the fact that I'm using a correspondence system whose origins really go back into these sort of like Western mystery schools, I find really interesting. Like historically, it's fascinating because nobody has applied them in this way. The original purpose of these musical correspondences to letters were to invoke archangels as well as demons. So people would go into what they call the vault of the adepts, and you know, with a magic wand, they would be describing different, you know, visual shapes. Each point on that shape would correspond to a different musical note and a different letter of the Hebrew alphabet. So, you know, Michael, Gabriel, Raphael, it's a, you know, your each letter of that name spelled out in Hebrew had a musical code to it. And that's as far as they went with it. So what I was really interested in doing in this book series is to detach from the traditional Western ceremonial approach and instead channel that energy towards just musical creativity, which is actually the thing that I find the most compelling anyway.
So you don't consider yourself an architect of the second matrix then?
No, because I'm really, I've, you know, well, you're aware of this. Like I've really wrestled with doing this research, right? Like I've actually like consciously dropped the project many times and said, I'm not going back to it. I'm done. And what I found is that it keeps coming back into my life in a way where it never lost its appeal to me. What does lose its appeal to me is this notion of like becoming a figure and being the spokesperson of it. I'm interested in sharing this technique with other people and talking about it, like other composers and other songwriters. I'm interested in the applications for songwriting and musical creativity and self-expression, way more so than I am in creating a second matrix. You know, I'm not, there's a lot of people in the field of astrology and esotericism who come off with this feeling of like, I'm an authority on this subject. And the truth is that spiritual entities, will follow exactly what you, you know, well, in the case of astrology, it's very deterministic, right? Like if certain planets are in certain signs, therefore your personality will be such and such way, or your fate will be this or that. Or, you know, with the more prescriptive forms of Western ceremonial magic, it's like if you intone this particular name with this particular set of musical notes in this environment, you will conjure that entity, and then here are the methods by which to communicate with them. Like that whole prescriptive method of magic is not interesting to me, but the prescriptive, like constraint based alpha numeric tone color system that they use for their ritual magic is interesting to me, because I think there's applications outside of that matrix of religious belief which could be useful to anybody regardless of what their belief system is. So you know, There is a little bit of creating a second matrix, but not without also calling bullshit on it and showing the whole historical lineage, you know, in its fullness to try to, you know, try to avoid creating followers or creating believers. Instead, creating an audience of people who question the narrative and can actually like actively play with it and experiment with it.
But you do want to create or inspire practitioners.
I want to inspire community. I mean, you have no idea. It's like as a musician, how frustrating it is to be like creating, you know, I've created hundreds of hours of music over the course of my life of home recordings that I have nobody to share with because the music market is so saturated, and not just the market in terms of money and finance, but just in terms of content. There's so much music. People don't even have time to listen to a song, or if they do, it's the song has to already have enough momentum culturally to be worth their while, right? So, and I'm sure you can relate to this as like a blog writer and writing books and stuff. It's like there's a desire for your work to receive recognition. And again, is this like this is where I can sympathize with Cohen if he had this sense of like, I'm not good enough. I need to work harder. I need to do more. Like, yeah, I have drive. I have ambition. And ambition has a shadow. The shadow side of ambition is that I'm not content to just be. I feel that there's something, there is a neurosis, or, if, you know, that's the pathological way of talking about it, but there's something within me that drives me to just continually create and expand upon this narrative. It's like an adventure for me because, you know, the weird thing about this is that even though it's been around for 100 years, I'm the first person to actually explore this content in depth and be turning it into this kind of work. Like it's so it has that element of being like an anthropologist or being out like discovering a new civilization. So that excitement is part of what drives me, much more so than being driven by a sense of being incomplete or not good enough or anything like that. But there's no way that I could pretend to just be content with myself for myself's sake, because that would be untrue. Like I am absolutely motivated by the desire to do better, be more, succeed, etc. And I see the correlation between that and what you're describing in Cohen's narrative. And that's where I can feel a little bit sensitive, like, oh, am I a bad person? Am I doing something wrong? Am I, it's like trying to hold this, this conversation away where I don't come out of it, with an unnecessarily like harsh judgment upon myself, but instead can sort of glean insights by it and allow that to motivate further creativity.
Well, I think that's very close to the core of what we've been talking about, actually, that juxtaposition of the energy of being and the energy of doing. And because I relate 100% to what you described and even how you described it, like my constant productivity and my enjoyment in it is somewhat tainted by or assuaged by that feeling of, well, why can't I just stop? Why can't I just be? Because it is, there's a compulsive element. And I think this relates to what we're talking about the medium and the message and whether the transmission of any specific soul relates to its wholeness, of course, and one aspect of that, or one manifestation of the wholeness or lack of it, is how capable a soul or psyche is of just being, and how much it's able to transmit from a place of being, as in to be, for being, for just to be enough, and then for a doing to emerge from that place of being. And that's an ideal thing. I'm not saying that, well, I guess I'm saying that I do experience that to some small degree, enough to be able to talk mm-hmm. about it, that some of the doings I do come from a place of, yeah, I'm very content with being, but now I'm going to do something because the body does stuff anyway, right? Whether even if I just sit here, I'm going to be doing stuff. So right. There's different energies of doing and different degrees of being in the doing, and I think that really is where the measure of the value of a transmission is how much is it transmitting being, or a contentment with being, or contentment, I don't particularly like that word, but just in just being itself, the beingness in the doing. I'm starting to babble now.
You're starting to sound like John
DeRozan. Yeah, right. Except like 90 miles an hour.
But it's funny, I feel very content even with this conversation, or just I feel like we've reached, a beautiful place where I feel like I've gained some insights, but at the same time, I'm also, there's still some room to explore, especially with Ann Diamond's work. So I feel like if we were going to continue that particular narrative, I'd want to study her work a little bit more.
Monkey said to man, I want your fire. Man said to monkey, I want your brain. Monkey said to man, my desire is to be like the mankind.
That is the end of my conversation with Ezra Sands Abel of audiomancy.net. You can find that link also in the show notes. And at Audiomancy, you will find links to Ezra's various creative works, the books, music, videos, etc. I don't have a guest lined up for next week. Something seems to be stalled with this podcast. I'm not getting responses from the people I'm reaching out to. Doesn't mean there won't be a podcast. There probably will be. In the meantime, once again, please support this podcast. Everything is appreciated, whether it's comments, emails, or donations. You can do any or all of the above or the below at the website horticulture.com. This is The Liminalist, the podcast between. You have now listened.
La vie dans la jungle, c'est quand même bien sympa. Des problèmes.
juste